It's Wednesday, June 5th, 2024, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Matthew Moore. Today, using data, photos, and videos to map historical wildfires in the Ozarks.
One thing that this story map does and these old fire-scarred trees do is they give us examples of different cultures and their relationship to fire.
Plus, a multi-million dollar gift to Hendricks College.
The plans for it is to fuel innovation and really invest in the next for Hendricks College.
And celebrating the 10th anniversary of Valley Inn.
Really, I have to say, was a bit of a blur because we only had 3 weeks. We were shooting 6 days a week.
All that after this hour's headlines from NPR.
Music Moves presents the 2024 Freedom Festival, celebrating Juneteenth, Saturday, June 15th, on the Shiloh Square in downtown Springdale. This community event features live music from Cameo, Twist, and Donnell Jones, food trucks, giveaways, a kids zone, and more. Information at freedomfestivalar.com.
This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 5th, 2024. I'm Matthew Moore. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Later on our show today, a major donation was given to Hendricks College by a former student. More details on that in about 10 minutes on our show. First today, researchers at the University of Missouri have documented historical evidence of widespread and recurring wildfires in the Ozarks by examining pine stumps and snags, some over 500 years old. The findings have been assembled into a multimedia presentation titled Fire in the Ozarks, Burning by Humans Has Shaped the Landscape. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this story.
Mike Stambaugh, an associate professor of forest ecology in the School of Natural Resources at the University of Missouri in Columbia, studies trees that have withstood forest fires.
So when a fire burns past a tree and it's hot enough, it will injure the tree and leave a little scar or mark on the actual tree, out on the outside of the tree. And through time, that gets embedded into the inside of the tree and stays there.
Even after the tree dies, so when these sap-preserved tree snags or stumps are sawn into segments, the growth cells or rings become visible, as do fire scars. This technique allows tree ring scientists like Stambaugh to track the incidence of fire through centuries in the Ozarks, which encompass south central Missouri, northeastern Oklahoma, and most of North Arkansas.
Starting in the 1500s, we see that fires occurred every, say, 8 to 15 years on average. Sometimes it was 2 years, sometimes it was 30 years, but about every 8 to 15 years, we would see a fire. And at that time, the fires were also potentially very large. We have certain years where fires burned in the same year in Oklahoma, in Arkansas, and in Missouri. And many of these years were also drought years. And so it is likely that some of these fires in the 1500s and 1600s and 1700s were hundreds of thousands, if not larger in size, maybe millions of acres of fire.
Fires that burned and moved for months, he says, unabated through grasslands, forests, and open woodlands of the Ozarks for thousands of years, a few ignited by lightning, but most caused by humans. Pre-settlement, the Ozarks were covered with open woodlands browsed by vast herds of elk and buffalo. Stambaugh says indigenous people used fire strategically to hunt game, as well as to clear land for subsistence agriculture, grazing, and plant medicines. Fire was also set for signaling and territorial defense.
When the Europeans got here, they actually burned more frequently than we see the indigenous people. They burned often every year, maybe every 3 years. In some cases, they even burned 2 times in a single year.
Starting in the 1860s through the 1920s, Ozark forests, both in Missouri and Arkansas, were logged, records show, for railroad ties and dimensional lumber, leaving behind a timbered wasteland.
And that's when the attitude about fire switched from, instead of it being positive, to a negative connotation of having fire in the forest. And that's really when we see the era of Smokey the Bear start.
Early fire prevention was a means to restore destroyed forests initiated by forest management starting in the 1930s. Foresters harvested trees damaged by fire and planted seedlings on scorched landscapes. Fire suppression was widely practiced to protect young, newly reestablished growing forests. Stambaugh says that 40 years later, intentional or prescriptive forest burning was deployed for the first time to improve forest composition.
Yeah, so in the late 1970s, just a small handful of people started burning areas that we knew were being transitioning to forests, like glades. And the response was tremendous in terms of the numbers of plants and animals that then flourished after the burns. And then this practice began expanding into forests. And there was a lot of question about whether or not forests should be burned or would respond the same way. And by and large, we see that, in fact, they do. They increase often in plant diversity. They increase in the types of species, you know, that we would consider resilient to not only fire, but wildfire, but also in the future climate change. Now we have a multitude of studies, such as what the consortium tries to promote, that shows the differing effects of burning on birds and pollinators and water quality and human perspective. So there's just a whole amazingly rich kind of connection between the environment, people, and fire.
Stambaugh's referring to the Oak Woodlands and Forest Fire Consortium.
The consortium is based out of the University of Missouri. And its mission is to increase the availability and consideration of fire science to those who make land management decisions. And we do this by publishing newsletters and fact sheets, hosting workshops, and then special projects like this story map.
Denise Henderson Vaughn is a Missouri-based science writer, podcast, and documentary producer specializing in Ozark natural resources, especially forests and karst topography. Her most recent project is Fire in the Ozarks, Burning by Humans, Has Shaped the Landscape, commissioned by the Oak Woodlands and Forest Fire Consortium, compiled as a story map, hosted by ArcGIS, which the public can freely navigate online.
In a story map, you'll find not only text, but lots of multimedia opportunities, such as slideshows and videos and lots of pictures and maps to make it more interesting.
The story map features a video clip of Joe Marshall, senior research associate at the Center for Tree Ring Science based at the University of Missouri, showing viewers a tree ring slab harvested from a pine-dominated Ozark forest in south-central Missouri.
In our lab's history, we have collected samples from over 40 different study site locations within the Ozarks, totaling well over 1,000 trees. This cross-section was cut from a dead shortleaf pine tree. The tree ring and fire scar record contained in this tree begins in 1706, which is the very center of the tree when the tree was germinated. And it goes out, the tree ring record goes in a continuous line all the way out to when the tree died in 1995. And in between all those times, it recorded 18 different fires. Each time that tree was injured by fire, it started to grow over that injury, which gives us a fire scar, which we can assign a date and sometimes even the season of injury.
Again, Denise Henderson Vaughn, producer of Fire in the Ozarks.
The Currit River watershed in south central Missouri was the focus of this, of the story map. And the reason for that is because The Center for Tree Green Science has done an incredible amount of study in the current river watershed. There have been 27 sites where trees have been sampled for fire scars. So there's a very rich database for the current river watershed.
Henderson Vaughn filmed A Key Source for Fire in the Ozarks, an elder native who describes engaging in community burns as a boy.
Howard Smith is a treasure. He grew up in the early 1900s, and as a community in Somersville, Missouri, everyone got together and had planned community burns. They would first backfire around their own houses so that their structures wouldn't get burned. Then they would go off several miles away and set fires that would burn in towards their structures. And this was to create forage for their livestock for the open range grazing.
But Mike Stambaugh says public opposition to intentional fire remains pervasive.
No, often there is a lot of opposition to controlled burning today because of the unfamiliarity that people have with fire in the Ozarks. And one thing that this story map does and these old fire scarred trees do is they give us examples of different cultures and their relationship to fire. And with that information, we can relearn our relationship with fire because it's been broken. Most of us do not use fire day to day in our way of life, but that's not the way it used to be. And so it's natural that our relationship with fire is broken, but we need examples from the past to understand how to live with fire. And this information really, really contributes to that.
Mike Stambaugh says the stories these old trees tell are hard to believe because they reveal a breathtaking incidence of fire in the Ozarks, far more than anyone knew. He credits the trees, as well as the story map, for finally revealing both the ecological as well as the cultural history of fire in the Ozarks to all of us. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The Arkansas Department of Health reports there were zero abortions in Arkansas in 2023. State law in Arkansas makes an exception for abortions that are performed to save the life of the mother in a medical emergency, but the health department's report shows zero were performed for those instances either. Family Council, an anti-abortion lobbying group, released a statement yesterday following the report saying that these reports are great news and, quote, Arkansas's pro-life laws are protecting women and they are saving unborn children. That is something to celebrate, end quote. Rebecca Bobro is the spokesperson for Arkansans for Limited Government, the group behind the proposed amendment to allow abortions in Arkansas. She says Arkansas women are still likely obtaining abortions. They are just forced to travel out of state to do so. She also says, quote, Arkansas providers have been thrust into an environment of legal chaos and confusion regarding how close a woman must be to death in order to receive abortion care. And it's so chaotic and confusing that they aren't providing that care to their patients, end quote. This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration will be hosting a public hearing for a proposed rule change regarding gender markers on driver's licenses and state-issued IDs. The meeting is scheduled to take place on Friday, June 7th at 9 a.m. in Little Rock in the Finance and Administration Office Building. Arkansas PBS will also be streaming on YouTube. Late last month, Hendricks College in Central Arkansas was granted a multi-million dollar gift from a former student. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth has the details.
Last week, Hendricks College in Conway received one of its largest financial contributions from a single donor. The private liberal arts school was gifted $4.6 million from the estate of Dr. William Bill Roberts, a Conway physician and alumnus of the school who died in February. Meredith Brunin is Vice President for Advancement at Hendrix.
Bill was, as I mentioned, a board member, a very loyal supporter, and a forward-thinking alum who attended Hendrix College many years ago.
Roberts graduated from Hendrix in 1965 and served on the school's board for 12 years. Brunin says the money will be used to invest in new academic and co-curricular initiatives and will be part of a larger innovation endowment fund previously established by Roberts.
Dr. Roberts had actually set up an innovation endowment at Hendrix several years ago and is adding to that with this latest gift. The plans for it is to fuel innovation and really invest in the next for Hendrix College. In another year or so, we're going to be celebrating our sesquicentennial celebration, 150 years of Hendrix College in its being. And so we really think that through a strategic planning process that's underway now, we'll be able to identify what those priorities are going to be for academic and co-curricular initiatives that'll really help support the college's residential liberal arts mission.
She explains the specific uses for the funds will be identified by the administration and Board of Trustees over the next year. Brunin says the gift comes at a critical time in higher education as many universities are struggling to keep up enrollment numbers and making hard financial decisions about curriculum and staffing, and it can be especially difficult for a liberal arts program like Hendrix.
Absolutely. All of higher ed, it's a challenging environment today with, you know, the enrollment cliff and just challenging in terms of finances. But I think what sets Hendrix apart is really the project-based learning, the residential, like you said, that liberal arts education where we get to focus on the students and really building their connection with the skills and the areas that they're choosing to focus on, but really focusing on the whole person, the development of a holistic individual as they're coming out with those soft skills as well as tangible practical skills.
She says new initiatives supported by the Roberts Innovation Fund are intended to become self-sustaining by 3 years of being established, and their success will be reviewed and based on increased enrollment and revenue growth. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
Daniel Carruth produces his stories inside the Karen Taha News Studio.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Killams. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, Aaron Howie, Jamie Baum, scientist at the University of Arkansas. This is a segment we've been calling Balance because we're trying to balance our lives and be healthier as well as balance information. Welcome back.
Thank you,
Kyle. Hi, Kyle.
So this time we thought we would take on or explore, I should say, intermittent fasting. This is a term I had not heard maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And now I hear it all the time. Jamie, what is intermittent fasting?
So intermittent fasting is really an umbrella term for a few different eating patterns or styles that really just talk about times of eating and times of fasting, just like the name suggests. I think the most common one people practice or you hear about on social media would be time-restricted feeding, where you have an 8-hour window that you will eat during the day and then you fast the rest of the day. So a lot of people will choose like 12 to 8 and that will be their 8-hour window and then fast for another 16 hours. The other one is alternative day fasting or 5-2 fasting where you'll eat for a period of 5 days and then you'll have severe restriction for 2 days, maybe only eating 500 calories a day.
So is the goal here to lose weight? Is the goal here to change your metabolism?
I would say all of the above.
Okay.
I think it's gained popularity because when it was first making the rounds around pop culture, it was one rule. You just eat in this window and you can eat whatever you want and you'll lose weight. The idea is that by cutting a meal or by cutting your eating window down, you're just going to naturally cut calories. But now I think they're finding what you eat within that window is also becoming important. It's not a magic bullet. You still have to be attentive to what you're putting in your body, whether or not you're participating in physical activity. They found, you know, it really isn't different than just following dietary patterns where you're restricting the calories you eat normally. In the long run, it works out the same results, but it seems to just be a lot less to think about. I just only eat between these times, one rule. And that's the appeal.
So, I mean, this is, for me, it's a relatively new term. Though, full disclosure, once I read about it, I found out that I'd been doing this for a long time because I don't eat breakfast generally. So I'll go sometimes 16 hours without eating. But do we know much about the effects?
So there are some effects that have been shown consistently. So people do tend to have improved blood sugar, or if you're at risk for diabetes or maybe early diabetes, it seems like some of those factors are improved by this method, and they stay improved the longer you follow it. It doesn't seem to have any extra benefit on, say, targeting losing fat or gaining muscle or long-term weight loss than any other plan. As we were talking before the show started, maybe there could be some positive effects on aging. Calorie restriction in general has been shown to help with longevity, and some data is coming out that maybe these dietary patterns can also help with that, but the science is still very new. And I think really more and more is coming out the more they research. So I think it's getting a little more sophisticated beyond the promise of weight loss now.
Erin, you know about exercise, and so this kind of gets into an idea I had long thought, especially when I was running longer distances, that I needed to have a meal at a certain time beforehand. Kind of going back, I don't know if when you grew up, your parents would tell you you couldn't get in the swimming
pool after swimming
45 minutes after eating. Do we know any sort of relationship between, is there any known relationship between fasting and exercise?
There is. I mean, your body needs fuel to move. Your muscles needs it there. And if you're fasting, your body will use whatever sources are available. So kind of one of the hypotheses around intermittent fasting is if you're exercising and you don't have sugar or carbs available, you'll use fat and break that down, which you're not as efficient at. And depending on your performance or what type of exercise you're doing, it might not be as good. And generally, we see that people who are fasting do have impairments to their performance during that fasting period.
But if I'm just, you know, my exercise is just like a 3-mile run, I might not care if it affects my performance. I mean, I might not care if it's a 7-minute mile versus a 9-minute mile.
Yeah, for sure. If you're just getting your physical activity in, right. And performance isn't an issue to you, I'd say one thing just anecdotally from people is it might make the experience less favorable for you. It might be more difficult. You might not feel very well after it, especially if you're not used to it. And so you might be less likely to do it. So kind of for your casual exerciser, that's just something to think about. If you already find it difficult to do exercise, adding fasting exercise on might make you very miserable.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the side effects. So it does take people a month or two sometimes to adapt to this new eating pattern and to figure out what window of eating is best for you as a person. So there's a lot of discomfort when you first start, one of these dizziness, a lot of hunger, inability to focus. Because I think traditionally we've heard about, you know, especially children needing to eat in the morning to focus at school or work during the day. So as someone who experimented on myself, you know, when you're used to eating breakfast at 5 a.m. and then you wait till noon, it can really cause headaches, dizziness, inability to make sense. But most people, once they've ridden that wave, they do find that their body adapts. And I mean, a lot of people enjoy that pattern because, like I said, one rule.
So I know that a lot of people become interested in intermittent fasting or start trying to practice or do practice because either a friend or someone online. I happen to know that Bruce Springsteen is someone who likes to intermittent fast. But I probably shouldn't only take my nutritional or health advice from Bruce Springsteen as much as I admire his songwriting.
Well, he is successfully aging, so there could be something to that longevity clue. No, I think it's also the buzz term of the last several years. I think it's impossible to not be on social media or the popular press and hear someone talking about time-restricted feeding or intermittent fasting and think, oh, it works for them, it must work for me. But it isn't a one-size-fits-all type of diet. So I think, you know, you have to think about what you're eating. Make sure you don't become nutrient deficient, because when you're skipping meals or eating less during the day, you're at risk for missing some important foods with vitamins and minerals. Like Aaron said, I think, you know, if you have important meetings or you are going to exercise, you have to think about the fuel and how that keeps you going.
Is there someone who you could talk to about intermittent fasting? Like, if you wanted to think about doing it, would that be like a registered dietitian, or because the CDC doesn't really have general guidelines for it?
No, and it's not in the dietary guidelines for Americans either. I think the best thing to do is to talk to a registered dietitian, nutritionist, someone who could consult with you to make sure you're getting the nutrients you need and the food you need while trying to cut back on energy restriction, and figuring out if that's the right thing for you. So a lot of times healthcare professionals can ask you questions about your preferences, your lifestyle. Maybe it is something that will work with your current lifestyle or work schedule, and maybe it's something that like you really need to keep fueled throughout the day, so it might not be the best fit. Or if you're at risk for diseases like diabetes or other metabolic issues, it might not be the right thing for you.
As you mentioned, it's not one size fit all. So I'm sure that some people who intermittent fast, maybe they do have breakfast and then they quit eating late afternoon or early evening. Some people might wait till late afternoon to start eating, then not have breakfast. Does timing of eating, or for that matter, Aaron, timing of exercise, does that matter?
Yeah, I think there's still a lot we don't know, probably related to like the exact window of fasting as well as exercise, because we do have natural circadian rhythms and we're all a little bit different. So we have different, they call them chronotypes, where some people are just early morning risers naturally and some are, you know, night owls. With exercise, they have looked most recently how late exercise affects your sleep. And for most people, it has no effect. So if after work you go to the gym and you do a 30-minute workout, whether it's strength training or you run on the treadmill, it's not going to impair your sleep at all. In fact, it might improve it. And generally, physical activity benefits your sleep. If you do really long exercise, so say you're marathon training and you decide to do that at 8 p.m. before bed, and you are an early morning riser, you'll probably have worse sleep and feel fatigued the next day.
Aaron Howie, Jamie Baum, thank you both much.
Thank you, Kyle.
It's been a pretty good last 10 years for making films in Northwest Arkansas. Several feature films were made here, attracting directors like Meg Ryan for her movie What Happens Later and Neil Abute for his House of Darkness, as well as actors like Ryan, David Duchovny, Kate Bosworth, and Justin Long. The third season of HBO's detective anthology True Detective made camp here for nearly a year. Smaller budget features like Greater and Max Winslow in The House of Secrets were also filmed here in the past 10 years. And another small-budget film, Valley Inn, starring Joey Lauren Adams and Natalie Cannerday, about a New Jersey college student suddenly sent to rural Arkansas, was filmed here and released in 2014, and it helped get the ball rolling.
Emily Mason and Madeline Reed, you're going to Hinesville, Arkansas!
75 people? Oh, seriously? I don't think this is legally a town!
First of all, do not, and I mean, do not sell Mama any of those books of yours.
How could this seem any worse?
The 10th anniversary of Valley Inn will be marked with a public screening Friday night in Fayetteville's Walker Park. Cody Ford with the Arkansas Cinema Society says the showing is a celebration and recognition of a burgeoning film industry in the region.
Really exciting to be able to celebrate a film that in some ways kind of kicked off the filmmaking scene in Northwest Arkansas. I mean, yeah, there had been some others, but you know, to me, like Valiant played a big role in really taking it to the next level. And obviously, you know, it helped launch Rock Hill Studios. And so, yeah, I think it's going to be really fun to team up with City of Fayetteville, you know, Arts and Culture Division, to do this film outside at Walker Park, you know, on the big screen so people can come out there for free. And, you know, it's going to be Friday, June 7th, and we are starting that at 8 o'clock. So we hope people come out. And one of the things for me is I had friends who were involved as cast members or crew members when the film was being made, and it was just really – and it was kind of an exciting time. And so, you know, a few months ago, I just thought about it. I was like, man, it's been 10 years since the movie came out. And so, you know, Kim and I just happened to reconnect for a bit. And I was like, hey, we should do this screening. This would be a lot of fun.
Cody mentioned Rock Hill Studios, now an established studio working with filmmakers from development to production to distribution. Co-owner Blake Elder, the president and CEO of Rock Hill Studios, and Carrie Elder, the executive producer and Blake's mother, were just beginning to work in the film business when Carrie's sister, Kim Swink, had co-written the Valley Inn script. Filming took place in Hinesville and other area locations, and the movie was released in 2014. Last month, I talked with Blake, Carrie, and Kim Swink via Zoom about their memories of making Valley Inn with a small budget. Kim Swink says the window to shoot the film was small, too.
Really, I have to say, was a bit of a blur because we only had 3 weeks. We were shooting 6 days a week, pretty much 18 hours a day, unless I'm making that up. Blake, we shot 18 hours a day, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess the shoot is a little bit of a blur. And then there was the post-production, and it just, you know, was a year and a half. Well, if you count everything, it was a, you know, multi-year odyssey that ended, you know, very pleasantly with what I think is a really sweet, beautiful little ode to Northwest Arkansas. So,
Blake, Carrie, what Kim just said, it was a blur, but I'm sure you have some memories. What do you recall from that time 10 or so years ago?
Oh, the first thing that sticks out for me was the opening title sequence we shot. Josh Donahoe flew up to New York, and we actually rode with Kim the route the character would have taken down to Arkansas, and we shot the whole way down. And that was
because the character starts out in New Jersey and then travels all the way to Hinesville. Anyway, sorry, Blake.
No, that one sticks out for sure. Shooting at the live rodeo of the Ozarks was a lot of fun. The people and relationships that we got to meet and know over the course of pre-production and shooting of just how open people were to just let us come in, whether it was shooting in their store or at their house. That was a great experience. It was like a big film camp, you know, everyone was close, and it was just a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a bit like summer camp. We mm-hmm. actually shot at Rodeo of the Ozarks.
Yes.
What was it, like a year and a half at least before we actually had the money and was doing the film. Chris and me and a DP from New York flew down there, and Blake and this other DP, Joe Arcadiacono, we got permission and we shot rodeo footage. And because we didn't have enough time during the actual film shoot, 18 days of film shooting, to shoot just B-roll of rodeo, we ended up using almost everything that we had shot just, you know, kind of on a whim 2 years earlier. So, yeah it's all coming back now.
Carrie, anything stick out for you?
It was a huge, huge, well, first of all, it was great fun and a privilege to watch my talented sister and very talented son, who are both super creative, bring this together. I had really very little to do with anything, with the script or with anything. I've considered myself a bit of a facilitator as far as locations or you know, putting together the I was a bit of a just a there in case I was needed. But I did take care of the accounting, the financial side of things, and it was a huge learning experience. I mean, it was I'm not used to kind of I'm a more office kind of person and one place all day long type of person, and this was quite the experience of watching them do this. So that it's a great memory, and it was a great opportunity for Blake and myself. We didn't really even know at the time that we were going to
change our lives,
start Rock Hill Studios, start making films. It put a passion in us to learn more about it and kind of try to
sense of security,
try to find a way that we could continue after this film, how we could continue to improve and to build the industry there in Arkansas, because like Kim said, there were so many talented people and
incredible.
Yeah. I mean, and crew. So we knew Blake
and crew. Yeah.
Yeah. So we knew that it was very possible that we thought there should be more films being made in Arkansas. So we began to, after that experience and what we learned, we began to formulate a plan for Rock Hill Studios and for making films together, he and I.
Kim, when I hear you and Blake and Carrie talk about creating a film, the thing, and I know nothing about this business other than I enjoy movies, but the thing that hits me is the patience required to see something through.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think part of it was we all had lots of other things going on in our life, so it didn't ever make us anxious or, I mean, I can't speak for Blake because I know that he was, you know, just chomping at the bit to shoot a film. He had done film school. He was so talented already, and he hadn't, you know, DP'd a film yet. But I knew because I had done some smaller things with him, and I knew he was ready, and he knew he was ready, and I'm sure his parents figured he was ready. And so that was, I guess, the only thing that made us a little impatient was really wanting to do this, you know, low budget heart film, but do it right and have it look like it ended up looking, which is very, very much a credit to Blake. But otherwise, I think that also to me is a bit of a blur. Of course, it's been well over 10 years since we were gearing up for it at various points. I never really thought we wouldn't do it. So I didn't get frustrated, but I guess I didn't even realize as it was happening how long it was taking. But yeah, filmmaking, Carrie and Blake can tell you more now because they're doing films all the time, but it's a long process. It just is.
Blake, Carrie, when was the last time you watched the film?
For me, it's probably maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
It's been within 3 years.
Yeah.
Because I'll watch it with you. Well, yeah. Someone comes around that I know hasn't seen it, and they're at my house, whatever. I'll say, hey, let's watch. They always ask about what movie and I'll say, here, let's watch A Valley Inn.
Nice.
Through the years, I've shown it, and I have actually given DVDs away to people for them to watch. And
something, I want to make note of, too, is it's worth watching the movie just for the soundtrack in itself. Yeah. It's all, Kim would know better, but I think it's mainly Arkansas musicians.
They are all either from Arkansas or living in Arkansas. Like Mary Steenburgen is from Arkansas, but she's not living in Arkansas. And then Amy Garland Angel is not from Arkansas, but she's lived in Arkansas since she was 20 something. So, you know, it's all either currently living in Arkansas or from Arkansas.
What was it like when it's done? It's ready to screen. Here's the story. Here's your work. What was it like to see it?
Oh, it was fantastic. It was like, you know, I've been writing and producing and directing in New York, but never, you know, a feature film. And that's probably every, you know, TV and film person's dream is just to have a feature film under their belt. And it, you know, it was a long haul, but once we really got started, I never stopped. It was, you know, it just kept going. So we were pretty driven to get it finished and then get it in film festivals. And
I would just add one thing, if you don't mind, Kyle, is that, yes, Blake and I have since been involved with and executive produced and all that, quite a few films, and almost all of them, all but two, were done here in Arkansas. And I don't think we've ever had as much fun, and they're all, you know, fun in their own way, but this one was just so much more pure in spirit and in intent. And it served such a great purpose. And in the moment, as Cody said, it was a moment when either there was going to be some people that took the industry to a level to make it just not a one-off place. Every now and then someone came to make a movie, or we were going to actually make it where people could make a living in filmmaking industry here in Arkansas. And that's really what happened. It's taken time, but that was a determining factor in us saying, yes, let's do what we have to do. And it was a lot of fun. It was tons of fun.
Carrie Elder, Blake Elder, and Kim Swink talked with me about the 10th anniversary of the film Valley Inn, shot in Northwest Arkansas via Zoom last month. An anniversary screening of the movie will be hosted at Walker Park in Fayetteville Friday night. The movie is scheduled to start at 8 Friday evening, and the showing is presented by both the Arkansas Cinema Society and the Fayetteville Department of Parks, Natural Resources, and Cultural Affairs. The showing is free and open to the public. There will be other events in the Movies in the Park series in Fayetteville through August. Another Arkansas-made film will be shown Sunday afternoon at the Arkansas Museum of Fine Arts in Little Rock. The 1956 political drama A Face in the Crowd stars Patricia Neal, Walter Matthau, and a young Andy Griffith. And Andy Griffith, who as cynical rising political star Larry Lonesome Rhodes, is far different than Sheriff Taylor from Mayberry.
You know what the public's like, a cage full of guinea pigs.
Good night, you stupid idiot. Good night, you miserable slob.
There are a lot of trained seals. I toss them a dead fish and they'll flap their flippers.
A Face in the Crowd will be shown Sunday afternoon beginning at 2:30 at the Arkansas Museum of Fine Arts in Little Rock. Tickets are $15 for general admission, $10 for students and seniors. Adding a new partner to Ozarks at Large beginning today. Soundbeat is a daily 90-second journey into the history of American recorded sound. Every day, we'll be able to tap into the holdings of Belfer Audio Laboratory at Syracuse University in Syracuse, New York. This collection includes music, film scores, spoken word, and speeches from historical figures like Amelia Earhart, Thomas Edison, and Theodore Roosevelt. Some recent episodes have featured Duke Ellington, Rudolph Valentino, and a dance lesson from Arthur Murray. Soundbeat is produced at Syracuse University Libraries, and it begins as a new feature of Ozarks at Large with today's edition.
Paul Robeson recorded Joe Hill, an anthem of the wrongly accused, in 1942.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night.
You're on the Soundbeat. Joe Hill was a Swedish itinerant worker and union activist. Many believe his involvement with the industrialized workers of the world led to his framing for murder in 1914, Utah. Evidence supporting Hill's innocence elicited clemency efforts from human rights advocate Helen Keller and President Woodrow Wilson. But to no avail. Hill was executed by firing squad on November 19, 1915.
They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man.
Defiant to the end, his reported last word was, fire.
Says Joe, I didn't die.
Singer and actor Paul Robeson was well known for his own activist ties at home and abroad, particularly by Senator Joseph McCarthy. As with many artists of the time, he was blacklisted, all but ending his performing career. Sign up for our podcast at iTunes and soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry.
We'll be sharing new editions of Soundbeat on every daily edition of Ozarks at Large.
Healthcare is a top priority for voters in the upcoming election.
It's important to note that Latinos have essentially had the lowest access to both health insurance and healthcare among any racial and ethnic group in the country over the last 10 years or so.
Our series, We the Voters, continues with a focus on healthcare and the uninsured on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Morning edition, tomorrow morning from 5 until 9. Speaking of health, the American Heart Association is teaming up with local partners, a local farm, local funders, and DoorDash in an effort to deliver healthy food to people who live in food deserts and don't have access to transportation. Brady Lacey, the Community Impact Director for the American Heart Association, recently came to the KUAF studios from his office in Little Rock to discuss the project that began earlier this spring. He says the Food as Medicine Initiative is funded by the Walmart Foundation and fits directly into the work of the American Heart Association.
One of our big priorities is nutrition insecurity in our Northwest Arkansas market. So we want to ensure we get those participants nutritious food and education through our local community partners and their staff to help them improve their nutrition health, plus their cardiac health with it. So kind of with this project, we partnered with a local farm, Cobblestone Farms, partnered with Community Clinic. They're a federally qualified health center in Springdale, and they have a bunch of clinics across the Northwest Arkansas market. And then partnered with United Way of Northwest Arkansas, which they have a program called the Last Mile Delivery Program. With DoorDash. So kind of with this program, the clinic, they enrolled about 300 participants into this program. So kind of how it works out is the DoorDash will go pick up the food box from the farm and then drop it off at the participant's home each week. That way they're getting that nutritious food. And if they have a transportation barrier, that takes away that. That way it's conveniently dropped off at their front door to get.
What's in the food box?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the season. So kind of right now they're getting carrots, some radishes, onions, and some cabbage. So it kind of gets into that hotter summer. It'll kind of change a little bit. So we'll have maybe like some okra, corn, and things like that as we kind of get more into the summertime. So it's kind of a variety of things.
So DoorDash, the way it physically works is Cobblestone Farms obviously produces the food.
Yes.
The 300 participants have been – connected through community clinic.
Correct.
And then DoorDash brings it to the door?
Yes, that's right. Yep. And then kind of with the food, we provide them with a grocery tote bag, you know, they can use when they go out to the grocery store. We provide cookbooks in English and Spanish. We provide other types of individual recipes that kind of aligns up with the food that's in the bags, and then plus some cooking utensils, some measuring cups as well. So that way they kind of have their full kind of cooking materials to have at home and things. So,
this is ambitious with 300 participants. Like, that doesn't mean 300 households, does it?
It's kind of like kind of set up is kind of the one person is kind of that individual participant.
Oh, so wow.
We kind of kind of through that form, we kind of see how many's in that household, because they complete a form when they register, just kind of make sure they qualify for this program, because we kind of make sure they are nutrition insecure, and then kind of with that delivery, they had to live within a 10-mile radius of the food box pickup with the DoorDash. So there kind of was those qualifying parameters we have to do with their patients.
So this – you launched this – in the spring, right? Early spring?
Yes. Today is 6 weeks since we launched. Okay. So today will be 150 deliveries we've done so far. It's quick and easy. You know, the time they're picked up, they were at the front door within, you know, 15, 20 minutes, depends on the radius of from pickup to their home. So they get it pretty quick. When the DoorDash does pick it up, they text them, hey, I've picked up your bag and I'll be at your house, you know, at this time and at this day. So they're aware that food's coming to them.
How did this come together?
Yeah, so kind of we've been working with the community clinic for the past almost 3 years now. We've got funding from Walmart Foundation in the past to do nutrition and security work. And through the previous program, we had the Lifestyle RX program. So with those patients, they were given 2 food vouchers, but they had to come back to the clinic to pick up their food box at a later date once the food conservancy dropped off their food bag. So kind of looking over a course of time, we were seeing some of the patients weren't coming back to get their bags due to transportation, maybe busy with work or, you know, other barriers that kind of comes up in life. So after we finished that program, we learned about the DoorDash program with the United Way of Northwest Arkansas and talked to them, and they were on board to help this, you know, with the free deliveries to the participants' homes. So that way we make sure they get food, and then they get that transportation barrier. If they do have it, they get delivered to their front door.
300 participants, that's ambitious for a first year.
Yes.
You may not be authorized to answer this question, but hope to continue, hope to grow?
Yeah, we're kind of in that next phase of 2.0, what we want to do next. So, yeah, we're kind of been discussing how we want to grow it in our next phase of when we do submit a proposal to the Walmart Foundation for more funding to kind of grow it as we go. Yeah, this was a pilot program, kind of, you know, start at the ground up and kind of build it as we go on. So, yeah, we are in that phase of speaking, you know, with our partners and how we can make it bigger and better.
Brady Lacy is the Community Impact Director for the American Heart Association in the association's Little Rock office. Our conversation took place in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at KUAF. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, the federally funded Affordable Connect program to help underserved households to be able to access broadband internet ended earlier this week.
As a result of that, there are many customers, millions of people actually across the country, and including here in Arkansas, who will no longer be receiving that $30 a month and $10 a month, depending on how they're receiving the benefit subsidy any longer.
What's next for options for low-cost connections to internet on tomorrow's show?
Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville. Contributors to today's show included Jacqueline Froelich and Daniel Carruth. Our community engagement manager at KUAF is Jasper Logan.
Matthew produced today's show inside the Bruce and Ann Applegate News Studio 2 at the Carver Center for Public Radio.
Kyle, good to have you back.
Good to be back. Good to be back.
You said that you were recognized by your voice while you were on vacation.
In Florida, yes. A gentleman who now works for Domino's Pizza in Detroit, but used to work for Tyson and listened to KUAF for years when he lived in Rogers.
Is that flattering or is that unnerving?
Sure. Sure, no, it's I would call that very flattering.
Yeah.
He was a nice guy, and we had a great conversation, and he really had good things. He had moved here from Chicago. Hmm. Great things to say about Northwest Arkansas, and was not a fan of the winters of Detroit.
Yeah, I could see that being true.
Yes. We're going to have another brand new show for you tomorrow.
That's true.
And it'll be at same time, same channels. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Matthew Moore.
Northwest Arkansas Pride returns June 28th through the 30th for its 20th annual parade and festival. Other weekend events include the 4th annual Trans March, Glitterville at George's Majestic Lounge, and High Tea Dance and Pool Party at Mount Sequoia. More at nwapride.org or NWA Equality's Facebook or Instagram.